I'm Emma Taylor.
I'm Joanna Shanks.
And this is Murder, She Spoke.
What's your quarantine chat this week, Emma? What have you been up to?
I have been getting into TV shows that everyone else started way, way before me, and now I'm super behind and I'm getting really excited about them, and everyone else has already seen them, which is a little bit rubbish, but also yay for me because I'm happy. So the one that I found the new series of is The Great British Sewing Bee, and there's only one season available, all the rest not available on the catch-up. Great British Sewing Bee is completely right on my street. It's got innuendos, eccentric British characters, creativity, there's a bit of competition, it's got a quirky judge. It's just amazing.
The Great British Sewing Bee, I would probably have put money on that that was the kind of programme that you would watch.
I'm just gutted that I've only found it now.
Why? Because then you have loads of episodes to watch, if you're able to find older episodes, of course.
Yeah, I'm struggling. I'm having to look online. I'm trying to find my sewing bee fixes.
Quarantine needs. I haven't been watching anything that lighthearted, to be honest. I'm sure you're really surprised to hear. I actually wanted to ask you if you have started watching The Innocence Files.
You sent me it and I'm going to, but I told Richard and he wants to watch it too. So we need to find time together to watch it.
It was really interesting, especially the first three episodes. I was watching it the other night and I had lots of thoughts on it. The first three episodes, they focused on several men that have been exonerated after being convicted on the basis of bite mark evidence. So bite mark evidence is quite controversial. A lot of people think it's junk science. And I think that the first bite mark evidence case was actually the Ted Bundy trial. The doctor who gave evidence in the Ted Bundy trial was Dr. Suveron, and he's actually featured in this programme. So he's an odontologist that he testified for the prosecution in Ted Bundy's trial. And when he was asked if he would give the same testimony today, he was pretty firm and said that he would give the exact same evidence. But then when he was asked to review evidence that he gave in the 1980s for another crime, he said he wouldn't be able to testify the same as now he has 35 years of knowledge.
Wow.
Right? Then, so he revisited his testimony. So this was a different case in the 1980s, because I think Ted Bundy's trial was also in the 1980s. He reviewed his testimony for this other case, and he actually ended up amending his testimony for this case. And that person, the convicted man, ended up being released.
Wow, that
is
insane.
On the basis of the new evidence. One of the people that the documentary focuses on is a man called Dr. Michael West. Emma, after you've watched it, we need to have a conversation about this man, because when I watch things on TV, I can't say that I'm really emotional. I don't have, really have emotional reactions. I'm frustrated, I'm concerned, and I'm interested, but I wouldn't say that I actively get worked up.
Whereas I get invested in people sewing.
Yeah, but this guy, I was getting so frustrated that I was making little comments to the telly as I was watching it. From his qualifications, you think, oh, okay, you know, he's well educated and had a good background and a lot of experience. And then you hear what he has to say and you're like, well, you're just full of hot air, basically. So the programme focuses on two men, Lavon Brooks and Kennedy Brewer. Lavon Brooks had actually been sentenced to life in prison, and Kennedy Brewer had actually been given the death penalty. They were both exonerated due to DNA evidence after involvement from the Innocence Project, and they were both convicted on the basis of his testimony. Apparently, this Dr. Michael West, his testimony was involved in six cases where people have been wrongfully convicted or indicted. And there's another case pending in the Mississippi Supreme Court currently.
Oh, do you know what needs to happen to that man?
What?
Someone needs to bite him.
Yeah. When you watch how he carries out the testing, so he was taking impressions of people's teeth. And then he was looking at a bite mark on a body, and then he was essentially rolling the teeth at like a 90 degree angle.
To try and make it fit.
Yeah. And the funny thing was, in one of the cases that showed you doing it, you compare it to see if it matches. And I'm like, oh no, it doesn't match. And he's like, and yes, it's a match.
No, it's not.
So it's quite controversial.
If he's rotating them, he's almost saying that you're biting sideways and your mouth doesn't work that way.
Exactly.
Well,
exactly.
Mine doesn't. Maybe these are kind of hybrid mutants, but most people's mouths don't work that way.
Exactly. And this Dr. Suvaron, the odontologist that testified in the Ted Bundy's trial, he sort of stood firm against what he does as well. But bite mark evidence has been massively disputed. And they were basically saying it's just unreliable. What they seem to be saying is that when taken in context with the rest of the evidence, perhaps it can provide some sort of insight. But it seemed that in a lot of these cases, it was the only evidence, the only actual evidence that was used to convict, alongside potentially an eyewitness testimony or circumstantial evidence. But it seems like this sort of formed the basis for the conviction. And I'll be honest, in the Ted Bundy trial, I actually think that this also formed a large basis for the reason that he was convicted. I could be talking absolute nonsense there, but I think it did. I remember it being an interesting point. It could be because it was a new technique at the time, and it was really, really interesting. And obviously that's to do with the work with the Innocence Project, which...
Amazing work.
Amazing work and an amazing job. If I had a law degree, I would be hounding them to work for them. I can imagine they must have so many people that want to work for them.
Mm.
And they're so dogged. It's so, just so commendable.
It's inspiring, really.
Oh, their passion and their drive. Because the thing is that, and one thing that really stood out to me when I'm watching this is, you've got people like the odontologist, so Dr. Suvaron and this Dr. Michael West. One of the reasons why I'm so frustrated about it is because for me, a lot of this comes down to ego. It's not that somebody says, hang on a minute now, we're all academics, we all need to educate ourselves, and where there's evidence to evolve that education, we need to go with that. And if there's evidence that leads to us questioning earlier testimony that we gave, to me, that's the part of education that you evolve your thought process.
Yeah.
Yeah, you evolve and you grow.
And things can change.
Exactly. But the thing is that for me, the really frustrating thing is that I see people like this Dr. Suvaron and this Dr. Michael West given this evidence and standing so firm by what they originally said. And I just think ego overrides everything. Rather than actually going, as science has advanced and as our knowledge has improved, there are questions being raised now that we need to revisit. But no, they're standing firm, even when they're presented with evidence that is quite clear. You wouldn't just stick to your guns?
They would rather an innocent person stays in jail than they be wrong.
Put your hands up and actually seek to learn from the advancements that have come around. And then you see people like the guy who was one of the founders of the Innocence Project. There's no evidence of an ego at all. Mm-hmm. And yet he's founded the Innocence Project. He's helped exonerate however many people that have been wrongly convicted. And then you've got this Dr. Michael West, and he's just sticking to his guns.
So you've been enjoying this, have you?
I have. But I'd be very interested to hear what you have to say after you watch it, because I think you would feel very similarly.
Yeah, I get really frustrated about things like that as well. I just don't see the need for the egotistical nature of people like that. And I think that especially in the world of crime and punishment, you do see allowances been given. You know, you look back at days gone by and, you know, we'll talk about cases and you'll say, well, you know, maybe the data collection or the evidence collection wasn't the same back then because they didn't have the same protocol. They didn't close off the crime scene. They didn't do this. They didn't do that because things evolve and that's how things go. There's different guidance in place. There's different guidelines that they follow. They're trained differently, and that's fine. That doesn't mean that they're bad people trying to do the wrong thing. At the end of the day, people that work in law enforcement, you would like to believe, are trying to get the right outcome. But if you have something presenting to you that it's really clear that, you know, maybe that wasn't what actually happened, despite your best efforts, good. I would be fighting to try and get it overturned myself. I thought that I'd put someone in jail.
I know, I agree. Another thing that I thought you might find interesting, on the 25th of April, it was the 13th anniversary of Brendan Dassey's conviction. And last thing I want to tell you about, actually, Emma, was a book that I read I read it in 7 hours, is a book called The Bigamist by Mary Turner Thompson, also from Edinburgh. Couldn't put it down, read it cover to cover. Really, really interesting.
So in our last episode, I did mention that we reached out to a Facebook group in around Edinburgh, and Mary Turner Thompson is one of the members of that group. And she actually reached out just to say that she wished us luck. Her story is almost unbelievable. I can't actually grasp it happening to someone in real life. We're not going to give anything away, but if you want to go and have a look at the book, it's called The Bigamist, Mary Turner Thompson, on Amazon. Google her, have a look.
Definitely, definitely recommend it. Now, I just want to take a minute to tell you about The Toolbox Scotland. They're located in Dalry in Edinburgh, a short walk from Haymarket. They sell loads, hand tools, power tools and garden tools at very competitive prices. They also have a website with free delivery on orders over £80. They sell a large range of brands, DeWalt, Craig, Makita, Stanley, Triton, Draper, Silverline, many, many more. They're open from Monday to Saturday if you want to stop by, or you can have a look online at their website, which is thetoolboxscotland.co.uk. That's thetoolboxscotland.co.uk. Would you like to hear about my case this week,
Emma? I would love to hear about your case. What have you got for me?
The case I've got this week is, strangely enough, another case from 1976, the same as my first case that I covered for Renee McRae. But this one takes place in Western Bartonshire, in Alexandria. I had never heard of this case. I feel like, I don't know about you, Emma, but I was gutted when I found out that Crime Watch had been cancelled.
Yeah.
Being the complete dork that I am, I used to watch Crime Watch every month. My sister and I used to message each other to tell each other when it was on. We also both used to have, I think it was the Crime Stoppers number in our phone.
Oh, I love that.
In case we ever saw any of the, you know, the list of
yes,
wanted
dodgy
people. The 10 people wanted by Crime Watch. We could phone the number immediately.
Oh, I love it. That's so cute.
That's how dorky we are. So I'd never heard of this case, and I feel like if Crime Watch was on, I would probably know about it. I want to put out there the hashtag Bring Back Crime Watch. I'll happily do the research and I'll happily present it because I bloody loved it.
But I need snacks. That's my only request.
I'm blaming the fact that Crime Watch has been cancelled for the fact that I don't know about this case. My case is about a woman called Mary Duncan. She was age 17. And I'll give you a bit of background about Mary. She had a baby girl named Laura, and she fell pregnant when she was age 15. She absolutely adored her daughter. She loved sewing, so she would make clothes for herself and her daughter, which I think is really cute because she was only 17. She was one of six children. She was the oldest. Her mum, Ruby, was a single parent. So single parent with six kids.
Wow.
Yeah. Tough going, definitely. She had three sisters and two brothers. Of the six, there was four girls and two boys. And they lived in a two-bedroom tenement.
Jesus.
Yeah. Well, I think that was common back in the day.
I think it was. I think it's just looking back.
Yeah, 1976. I mean, I know my nana was one of five. And I think they lived in, I think it was like a two-bedroom.
Absolutely. I know that it was incredibly common. It's just when you think about it, how lucky we are.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. Well, they lived in a two-bedroom tenement and it didn't have an inside bath either. Yeah, it must have been really tough on her mum. Apparently she loved the Osmonds and they were quite a close family and she had a good relationship with her sisters. Like, they were friends as well as sisters, which I think is lovely. As well as being a devoted mother, she was a happy, quiet girl.
Aww.
So as I say, she was 17. She worked as a machinist in a place called Ross Head. And she lived at 51 Third Avenue in Bon Hill in Alexandria, which is in Western Bartonshire. Now, I had a little look at this on Google Maps just to see the location. It's actually not that far. Do you know Cameron House on Loch Lomond?
I do, yeah.
Really not that far. It's in an area called Vale of Leven.
Okay, yeah.
So Vale of Leven, yeah, and as I say, not that far from Loch Lomond and Luss.
Beautiful part of the world.
It is beautiful. I love Loch Lomond, Luss. On March 19th, 1976, she left home to go and visit a friend in Tullytune, and she was never seen again. Now, on the day that she disappeared, she didn't take her daughter with her.
Do we know why?
No.
No.
Given that they were a close family, I imagine that her sisters and mum and stuff probably...
Minding the wee one.
Yeah, I would imagine that they probably helped her out with her daughter and, you know, taking care of her and things.
Might have been a bit of respite for her just to go and see a friend and be a normal teenager.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, think if she had a job and she was 17 years old and, you know, she was working, she probably needed to, I would imagine, rely on her family a little bit to help her look after a little one. And I think from what I could tell, she was still living at home. Yeah, I think they were probably helping her out. And so she went to see her friend on March 19th, 1976. And she was never seen again. So her daughter wasn't with her that day that she disappeared. Now, since that day, there have been no sightings of her since. She's never paid tax, national insurance, and she's never claimed benefits. So her family basically saying, look, she didn't leave by choice. She didn't have any money on her. She would never have left her daughter behind. She absolutely adored her. She was a naive 17-year-old girl. She didn't really have many life skills. To actually choose to walk away and start a brand new life, they just don't believe that was the case. Mm. Mary's sisters believe that she had a doctor's appointment on the day that she disappeared, where a second pregnancy was confirmed.
Oh my God.
Okay, so that's what they believe.
Can I ask a question? The first baby that she had, Laura, do we know who the father was?
No. No mention of it.
Okay.
Now, 5 months after Mary went missing, her daughter Laura, so at the time Mary went missing, her little baby girl was 13 months old. Mm-hmm. So 5 months later, at the age of 18 months, her daughter died of bronchial pneumonia.
Oh my God.
She died in her grandmother's arms.
Oh, that's horrific.
The family have said not only were they dealing with the loss of Mary, but now they've lost their granddaughter, essentially. Her mum's lost her granddaughter. They've lost her child at the age of 18 months, which I would imagine in any circumstances would be absolutely horrific. But added to the fact that she disappeared 5 months earlier, I cannot imagine the grief the family would be suffering. They had contacted a doctor and she'd been given some advice, but the baby died. And a horrible detail that I found out while I was doing the research for this case, Mary's mum Ruby was Laura's grandmother. So she died in Ruby's arms. Ruby never slept upstairs again since that day. She slept on the couch from that day forward, which I think is just heartbreaking.
It's funny how situations do things like that to you, isn't it? You know, sometimes there's just a mental block that you really can't get past, just trauma of something.
Oh yeah, trauma, absolutely for sure. Horrific. In the late 1990s, Mary's sister Debbie, so Mary was the oldest, suddenly had a flashback that she'd been sexually abused as a child. Apparently it was memories that she'd buried until that point. She worked in a school, I think she was a cleaner in a school, and it was just something as simple as a song coming on the radio that triggered the memory, and all of a sudden she just had flashbacks. So things that she'd obviously buried as a child that she didn't know how to deal with or couldn't deal with, whatever, and they sort of resurfaced. In the late 1960s, Mary's mum Ruby met and married a man by the name of Norman Duncan. Mary would have been around age 10 at the time that they met and married. Now, apparently Norman built an extension in the flat, in the tenement, in which Mary's brothers slept, which separated the boys and the girls. Now, Mary's sisters were informed that Norman Duncan was seen around Mary's friend's house the day she was visiting her friend. So she went to see her friend in Tullytune. There's mention that he was seen around that friend's house in that area at the time of Mary's visit. In 1999, Debbie approached the police about the abuse that she suffered. following the resurfacing of the memories. So she approached the police about the abuse she suffered at the hands of her stepfather, Norman Duncan. But without further evidence, it would be her word against his, so no further action was taken. Mary's other sister, Mandy, also confessed to being sexually abused by her stepfather. So that's two of the four girls, with one of them being missing. And I believe the other sister wasn't sexually abused. Now, a case against Mary's stepfather began to build at this point, after they contacted the police about these memories resurfacing, and her other sister also approaching the police. Now, I don't have a lot of information about this. It could be because it's still an open case that I don't have a lot of detail, but there is mention that a historic blood sample proved that Norman Duncan had committed historical sexual abuse, and he was charged and found guilty of the abuse of the girls. Now, I don't have any more information about that.
That is so intriguing.
It's intriguing, isn't it? And I do assume it's because it's an open case that I couldn't get any more information.
I'm guessing that your mind is going the same way as mine, in that quite likely the baby was as a result of sexual abuse.
That's my thoughts, exactly.
Both children, most likely.
The fact that she'd fallen pregnant at age 15 and there was no mention of the father, I immediately thought sexual abuse. Just from what I've read, my own assumptions, I believe that he was the father of that child. The fact that she was potentially pregnant with a second child, I believe he was potentially also the father of that child. Perhaps she'd threatened to out him or something, I'm not sure. But I fully believe that he abused her and was potentially responsible for her death as well.
It's horrendous. The thing that got me was the age, and also the description of her as a really
naive, I know, quiet.
Yeah, naive, shy and quiet. I just, not that we're falling into any stereotypes here, but it seems somewhat unlikely that a young teenager who just wants to stay at home and, you know, look after her family and stay with her mum and her siblings, which, to be fair, if you'd been sexually abused, your siblings were there as well. You read so many stories where people put themselves in the firing line instead of their younger siblings because they want to protect them. The same with domestic abuse as well, which is absolutely horrific, but it is something that you hear reported, you know, that they'd rather themselves have the abuse than let the more vulnerable ones take it.
Definitely.
I mean, this really does seem like it can only point to him.
That's what it looks like to me. So in 2006, he was sentenced for abusing four girls during the 1960s and the 1970s. His victims were between the ages of 8 and 15 when they were attacked, between 1968 and 1976, and he was sentenced to 5 years in prison.
5 years?
Mm-hmm. I think he was age 71 at the time of his conviction. It doesn't say who the four victims were that he was found guilty of abusing. I assume that two are Mary's sisters, but I don't know who the other two are.
That's interesting, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You wonder.
Then in April 2019, police began searching his former home at 128 Ladyton Estate in Bonhill in Alexandria. And apparently forensics and CID searched the home, with some focus being on the back garden of the property. Now, the investigation is still ongoing, and police would like to speak with retired detectives and those that were involved with the case from Strathclyde Police. Obviously, it's now Police Scotland, but at the time it was Strathclyde Police. Now, Mary was also known to frequent the grounds of Vale of Leven Hospital, so police also want to speak to any patients or employees at Vale of Leven Hospital in 1976.
Do we know why she frequented the grounds there?
No.
It's an odd fact, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? I thought maybe she was visiting a friend, but it seemed to focus on the fact that she frequented the grounds.
I don't know, perhaps it's somewhere nice to walk around. I mean, it seems odd.
That's what I thought. I thought maybe it's pretty and maybe she liked to walk around there. I'm not sure. Don't know it personally, so I'm not sure. They also want to speak to anyone from the local area who did or didn't initially come forward. So regardless of whether people initially came forward or not, they still want to speak to people again. 19th of March 1976, so around about that time, the grounds of Vale of Leven Hospital, she lived in 51 Third Avenue in Bonhill, Alexandria, and Norman Duncan lived at 128 Ladyton Estate in Bonhill. So anyone who was around the area at that time they want the public or anyone to come forward and contact Dumbarton Police Station on 101, which is obviously the non-emergency number for Police Scotland. And there's a bit more information on Police Scotland website as well. So that is the case of Mary Duncan. It's still an open case. She's still missing. No body's ever been found. There's been no sightings of her at all. There's been absolutely nothing.
Something that I reckon they would do if they found fit to do so, if they could DNA test the baby, the one that passed away.
I assume they have. I think that was maybe the basis of the blood sample.
That's what I was wondering.
When it said that a historic blood sample proved he'd committed historical sexual abuse, read to me like they'd tested the baby's paternity.
Yeah. So they would have had to exhume the poor baby, which is horrific as well.
Yeah. Unless they had a blood sample on file for the baby. I'm not sure how these things work.
I guess the thing is with children passing away, sometimes to make sure it's not under suspicious circumstances, maybe they do take samples, but I wouldn't be convinced that they're kept for that long.
Also, bear in mind, this was 1976. I know we've said it before, but that was a long time ago.
I feel like it's more likely that they would have had to exhume, which is very, very sad. But ultimately, if that is the outcome that it led to...
If that's what happened, if they tested the baby's DNA and they determined that he was the father of that child and they therefore were able to link him to the abuse, then that is a really positive outcome. And I would imagine it contributed massively to him being convicted in the end. But it's also still a horrific thing, isn't it? And it still brings the family no closer to finding Mary.
I wonder, for Ruby as a mother, how that must feel. You know, she's lost her daughter, she lost her granddaughter. Two of her other daughters are saying that this man abused them. And this is someone that she brought into her home.
I also think as well, if I, even now, but I think more so then, if you were a single parent with six children, I think it would be a hard task to meet someone who would be...
Willing to take on a larger family that wasn't technically their own.
I think it would be a hard task to meet someone who was that committed to you that they would not only get into a relationship with you, but also appreciate and understand and become involved with the fact that you had six children. I think that's a big expectation. So I think it's understandable if she was like, wow, I finally met someone and, you know, things are going well and he's willing to support me and my large family. I think that's, and especially in 1976, I feel like that would have been quite a big deal.
I think that's also another level of heartbreaking for the mother. To think that you'd find someone genuine and
a predator.
Absolutely. For all we know, he wasn't interested in her in the slightest. She was a gateway.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's a horrible thing to say, but when I was reading it and I was looking at it, I thought, to me, this just looks like a predator. Men that approach, especially single mothers, if they've got paedophilic tendencies, single mothers would be absolutely the type of people that they would prey on.
Yeah, to get access to their children.
To get access to the children. And the fact that she had, you know, four girls and two boys, the fact that the extension was built, which separated the boys and the girls, it seemed to indicate, although it wasn't said specifically, but it seemed to indicate that it allowed abuse to go on without it being known.
It indicates that he had a preference for the girls as well, although for all we know, the boys may have been abused also, but
yeah,
either for various reasons didn't come forward.
Absolutely. We don't know that they weren't, but as I say, he was convicted of the abuse of four girls between 1968 and 1976.
What a monster. I just feel so sad for victims like Mary, who never got the chance to live their lives.
Yeah, I agree. It sounded like she, despite what she potentially had gone through and potentially what had led to her having her daughter, you know, the accounts from her sisters were that she adored her little girl. She had a job, you know, she was living with her family. She liked sewing and making clothes for her and her daughter. In my head, I've got a picture of just such a sweet girl. And 17 is really young. really young. I mean, I know that she was technically an adult and a mother, but to me, she's still a girl. She's still young. She's got her whole life ahead of her. And the loss of Mary's daughter will have just been a massive blow to the family on top of not knowing what happened to Mary. And the fact that, you know, we're 40 odd years down the line and it still hasn't been solved. They haven't even found her body. Do you know what I mean? She's still missing. She, you know, it's not even like her remains have been discovered. They need closure. So if anyone does have any information and they could come forward and provide the police with any information, no matter how small it might seem, then that could go a way to helping solve the crime.
That was an amazing case. I really appreciated it. I think that it's definitely an unknown one and one that to us would maybe have a quite obvious conclusion. But mm-hmm. once again, until that's proven or until she's found, it's highly unlikely that he was the only predator operating in Scotland at that point in time.
Exactly.
Therefore, it may be a massive red herring just because he absolutely fits the bill.
Mm-hmm.
For all we know, she could have been abducted by a complete stranger.
Yeah. So do you have an interesting true crime fact for us, just to lighten the mood a little bit?
I've gone lighthearted because why not? Did you know reindeer make excellent getaway cars? In Siberia, people often use reindeer to escape from crime scenes. The Russian police are now asking to have their snowmobiles replaced with reindeer. Once again, it's from the internet. I'm going to caveat it. That may be utter nonsense, but I love it regardless. I like reindeer and crime, so we're going with it.
What is the... I don't even know what my question is.
Don't question it. Don't question it. Don't question it.
Getaway reindeer.
Getaway reindeer, yeah.
I guess it must be because it snows there so much.
Yeah, I think so.
That maybe cars are not so good, whereas reindeers can master the snow.
And I think snowmobiles are limited as to what, you know, they can't go through wooded areas. So, for example, if you're on a reindeer, it's an animal. It can circumnavigate trees. It can, you know, so.
Oh, you mean on a reindeer, not being pulled by a reindeer?
Well, the picture that I saw seemed to indicate that someone was on the back of a reindeer.
Oh, so you're riding it like a horse?
Well, I mean, that's what the picture looked like. But once again, this is the internet. So I think we should decide that the new version of the fact is that people hop on the back of reindeers and run away with bags of money, but they also look like the burglars. So, you know, they've got like the hat on and like a swag bag.
The black and white striped
yeah.
prison garb. That's hilarious. I love that.
So, yes. Yeah. So
did you say it's Russia?
Yeah. Was my last one not about Russia?
I was just about to say, your last fact was Russia as well.
That was Russia. You've been listening to Murder, She Spoke. If you want to get in contact with us, you can email us at info@murdershespoke.net. You can find us on Twitter at @MSS_pod. We're on Instagram at @MurderSheSpokePod. And we're also now on Facebook, Murder, She Spoke Podcast or MSS Pod. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you in a week.